From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the news this week, Hillary Clinton makes history, shatters one of the biggest glass ceilings, and goes right after Donald Trump.
Donald Trump is temperamentally unfit to be president.
And Trump fires back.
The last thing we need is Hillary Clinton in the White House or an extension of the Obama disaster.
Americans said goodbye to the greatest, legendary boxer Muhammad Ali.
Ali helped this country move closer to its own ideals. He helped America do and see some things that America was not quite ready to do or see on its own.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable. You can join us on air or online. Are you ready for Clinton Trump? Are you grieving for Bernie? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Lisa Lair, national political reporter for the Associated Press. Hello, Lisa. Good to have you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Also with us from Washington is Katie Zezima, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Katie, great to have you.
Hey, Anthony, thanks for having me.
And as always, from Hanover, New Hampshire, our own Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Anthony, Katie, and Lisa.
Well, folks, let's start with the Democrats and a big week for Hillary Clinton, the presumptive presidential nominee and the first woman ever to get that far in a major political party. Lisa, I'll start with you. You interviewed Clinton this week. What did you take away from that? How is she casting her line of attack against Donald Trump in the general election?
Well, it was a fascinating interview. I had about 20 minutes with her. And one of the most interesting things that I took away is that in some ways, I think she believes that going after Donald Trump will be a little bit easier politically than the tightrope she had to walk with Bernie Sanders. With Sanders, of course, she had to really hold herself back from going after him at full force. I think people forget that Hillary Clinton is someone that's known as a little bit of an attack dog. She's someone who really likes the fray and the back and forth of politics. With Donald Trump, of course, she can be unleashed and just go after him. And that's what she did in my interview. She said she likened him to a demagogue, the kind that we've seen across the world and across all times. So it was pretty strong language. Of course, with Bernie Sanders, she had to worry about eventually winning back his supporters once the primary was done. And that's the process she's in now. So in some ways, I think she feels a little unbound by the prospect of facing Donald Trump and now moving into the general.
Interesting. Sounds like you're saying maybe even a sense of relief that the primary campaign is now finally over, even as she prepares for what's going to be a long slog against Donald Trump and not an easy one.
Oh, for sure. You know, this was a primary campaign that went on far, far longer than anyone expected. And I think it really speaks to what we saw on both sides of the electorate, this just deep unhappiness with politics as usual, this eagerness to sort of burn it all down and start again. And, you know, this was something people forget that when Hillary Clinton entered the race, she really had no opponents. There were a lot of people who sat this one out, including Elizabeth Warren, who she's meeting with actually right now on Friday morning. So, you know, she entered this race as really the prohibitive front runner. And she ends it after a pretty long primary slog that went really until the final primary contest.
All right. You mentioned the endorsement from Elizabeth Warren. Of course, President Obama endorsed Hillary Clinton yesterday as well. Let's hear from him. Here he is. The endorsement came in the form of a video that was recorded last Tuesday, but released yesterday.
I know how hard this job can be. That's why I know Hillary will be so good at it. In fact, I don't think there's ever been someone so qualified to hold this office. She's got the courage, the compassion, and the heart to get the job done. And I say that as somebody who had to debate her more than 20 times.
So the endorsement came after a White House meeting with Bernie Sanders, who is both vowing to continue his campaign at least through next week's D.C. primary. But he also vowed to do everything he can to defeat Donald Trump. I want to come to you. Are top Democrats and Clinton loyalists satisfied, comfortable that Sanders is going to get in line, I guess, and play nice? What do you think?
Well, you know, I think one of the things you see is with President Obama's endorsement, he is really going to have to be the great uniter of the Democratic Party here. Senator Sanders has a huge following, a loyal following, and, you know, many of them are fed up with that system. And President Obama is really the one now who's kind of brokering, and people on the Hill brokering this, you know, this truce between them. You know, Senator Sanders said it yesterday. He wants to do everything he can to defeat Donald Trump. So, you know, this is really kind of the start of a reconciliation of sorts and of a unifying of sorts that, you know, if the party does, in fact, want to beat Donald Trump in November, they have to start doing.
Yeah. Let's listen again. This is again from President Obama's taped endorsement of Hillary Clinton, where he talks about Bernie Sanders and actually praises Bernie Sanders. Here's a bit of that.
Just like 8 years ago, there are millions of Americans, not just Democrats, who've cast their ballots for the very first time. And a lot of that is thanks to Senator Bernie Sanders, who has run an incredible campaign. I had a great meeting with him this week, and I thanked him for shining a spotlight on issues like economic inequality and the outsized influence of money in our politics, and bringing young people into the process. Embracing that message is going to help us win in November.
So President Obama there talking about Bernie Sanders in that taped endorsement of Hillary Clinton. Jack, what do you think? What about Bernie supporters? There were grumblings that the president should have waited until after the D.C. primary before endorsing Clinton. You know, what has to happen to convince them to rally behind Clinton? Will they?
Well, I think Donald Trump is going to help. You know, a tweet from a man named Jordan Stratton caught, I think, the issue very well. Since Bernie didn't win the nomination, I'm going to vote for Trump. Also, since the store didn't have my favorite beer, I'm going to drink bleach. I mean, that, you know, that's kind of what they're faced with. If I may, Anthony, can I just go to Hillary just for a second? Why did she win? Well, you know, in part because of the appeal of her character. I know that's supposed to be her weakness, but consider this appreciation from Amy Chozick in The Times. She may not be the orator President Obama is, or the retail politician her husband was, but Mrs. Clinton's steely fortitude in this campaign has plainly inspired older women, black voters, and many others who see in her perseverance a kind of mirror to their own struggles. And Mrs. Clinton's very durability, her tenacity, grit, and capacity for enduring and overcoming adversity could be exactly what is required to defeat Donald J. Trump.
Interesting. Well, Lisa, respond to that, because, I mean, of course, one of the things Hillary Clinton will have to overcome as well, as the polls have suggested, these very, very high negative ratings, which she shares with Donald Trump to equal measure.
Yeah, I mean, she has unprecedentedly high unfavorability ratings for a candidate in a presidential race. And in fact, the only person who's had higher unfavorability ratings is Donald Trump. So this is going to be a really interesting election. When you get out there and you talk to voters, you hear a lot of people who tell you that they don't like any of the choices and they don't know what to do. You know, but it's still early, although for political junkies like us, it feels like this has been going on forever. A lot of people really don't tune in until after Labor Day. So I think her campaign believes that they were really happy with the foreign policy speech that she gave last week, where she just went after Donald Trump really hard. They think that's a winning message for her. I think there's a little bit of a debate in Democratic circles about whether it's enough for Hillary Clinton to be simply not Donald Trump and, you know, engaged someone who's committed to stopping Donald Trump, or whether she has to present her own vision for the country aside from being against Donald Trump. I think that part is a little murkier. She really hasn't found a clear slogan. She has no Make America Great. So that's something her campaign will have to navigate in the coming months. But I think they're looking forward to moving into this phase. The politics for them are a little bit clearer than the balancing act that they had to walk in the primary.
I want to ask all of you sort of what you think about the Bernie Sanders factor going forward. I mean, it seems like there's two ways to look at it. On the one hand, you could ask, you know, what does he want and what does Hillary give him? A primetime speaking spot at the convention, big input into writing the party platform. But on the other hand, it seems like you could argue that this is really about what Bernie Sanders is prepared to give Hillary Clinton. I mean, doesn't she really need him I'll start with you, Jack, on this. I mean, really, to sort of try to transfer the kind of passion that he managed to ignite for his own cause to her.
Well, he's going to try, and I think Elizabeth Warren, with her full-throated endorsement of Hillary Clinton last night, following her, you know, acidic estimation of Donald Trump. I mean, no one hits Trump as she does. I think she's going to mediate that transition. I mean, she clearly has great appeal to Sanders voters, and I think she's going to carry a lot of them along. And Bernie, I think, is going to get with the picture once the D.C. primary is behind him.
All right. Well, speaking of Elizabeth Warren, so last night, as you mentioned, Jack, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren really went after Donald Trump. I mean, as you said, she spoke out in favor of Hillary Clinton, then went after Trump for his comments about Judge Gonzalo Curiel, the federal judge presiding over the fraud case against the now defunct Trump University. Here's Elizabeth Warren.
Understand what this is. Trump is criticizing Judge Curiel for following the law instead of bending it to suit the financial interests of one wealthy and oh-so-fragile defendant.
So, Katie, what do you think? What does Elizabeth Warren bring to the Hillary Clinton cause?
She's the attack dog. She is the one who is getting in there and getting in the trenches and really just pummeling and pummeling and pummeling and pummeling Trump. And, you know, Trump is pummeling her back. He's calling her Pocahontas based on her, she claimed that she was Native American, and he's doing that. But she's really kind of relishing this role as attack dog and just punching and punching and punching and punching Trump right now.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about a week in the news. You can join the conversation. What do you make of Trump's bad week? Will the teleprompter help him reset his campaign? Can Clinton Sanders followers get behind her? Will anything change in the wake of the Stanford rape case? We're joined today by Katie Zezema, national political correspondent for The Washington Post, Lisa Lehrer, national political reporter for the Associated Press, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Folks, before the break, I want to just follow up a little bit on the Elizabeth Warren question. There's talk, chatter about the possibility of a vice presidential slot for Elizabeth Warren. Is this serious? Is this just a way to mollify Sanders supporters? Katie, let me come to you first on that. What do you think?
Well, you know, given that they have been talking, you know, there is always this time of the election, there's always chatter who could be the vice president, who may not be the vice president. You know, they are meeting, which is definitely, adding fuel to the fire. But, you know, for many Sanders supporters, they do hear this potentially and see that Clinton is reaching out to someone like her. And, you know, in many ways, it is kind of that bridge between Sanders supporters and Clinton supporters. You know, she is talks about populism and all of those things. So in some ways, it can be seen as a bridge, the fact that these two are meeting and that the factions may be coming together.
Yeah. Lisa, what do you think? Do you think it's realistic, though? I mean, I have a hard time imagining it only because two Northeastern liberal. I mean, what would usually when you think of a vice presidential pick, you're really trying to think of someone who is going to represent a different part of the country, a different set of political values, maybe, or maybe appealing to a different set of people. What do you think?
Well, I think the idea of picking a vice president based on their state they're from to win that state is sort of an outdated notion. I think the way the process works now is much more about demographic groups. You could make a strong case for Elizabeth Warren that she would attract the progressive wing of the party. It would certainly be very exciting, unprecedented, of course, to have two women on a ticket. That would be something that could excite a lot of people, particularly female voters who will be crucial in this election. So there's a case to be made. But of course, there are plenty of negatives, too. And I think the biggest question here is whether Elizabeth Warren would want to do it herself. Obviously, also whether Hillary Clinton wants to share a ticket with Elizabeth Warren. But, you know, for Senator Warren, she has a really strong position in the Senate. If Democrats are able to regain control of the Senate, she'll be particularly powerful. And if Hillary Clinton wins the presidency and she remains in the Senate as, you know, in leadership, she could have a really important role pushing that administration to the left on various issues. So, you know, I think that she'd have to make a real political calculation here. Part of what we're seeing, I think, is Elizabeth Warren stepping in to claim back her movement. Don't forget, nobody was clamoring, very few people, I should say, were clamoring for Bernie Sanders to run for presidency. There was a movement to draft Warren, to get Elizabeth Warren to challenge Hillary Clinton. She decided not to. She sat it out. She was quiet for the months and months and months of this primary. Now she's reemerging and she's sort of saying, okay, I'm taking my people back.
Interesting.
You know, so Lisa, I think, you know, she's making some real political calculations here.
Sure. Jack, I want to get you in on this. You know, a moment ago, Lisa was talking about, in the wake of her interview with Hillary Clinton, that she sort of sounded like Hillary unbound. Are we seeing Elizabeth Warren finally unbound or again unbound?
We sure are. You know, Governor Ed Rendell, the former governor of Pennsylvania, said she isn't ready to be president, that because the vice president has to be looked at in that perspective. She doesn't have the experience in foreign policy. Asked last night straight away by Rachel Maddow, do you have the foreign policy, national security background to serve as commander in chief? Elizabeth Warren gave a one word answer: yes. So that's it seems to me that's that yes has a resonance. I heard it almost as saying, yes, I do, but also yes, if anybody offers me this job.
Let's go to Jen, who is calling from Harriman, Utah. Hi, Jen, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Hi, Anthony. I just wanted to call in. Living here in Utah, there is a lot of anti-Hillary sentiment. I mean, among the vast majority of Republicans, and I'm a Democrat myself, it's Bernie one-handedly in the caucus. So for me as a Clinton supporter on Tuesday night, it just felt really good to revel in her accomplishment. Her speech was so inspiring to me. And, you know, it made me feel really good as a Clinton supporter to be proud that I want her to be president.
Jen, thanks so much for that call. Obviously, an impassioned supporter there for Hillary Clinton. Let's go on to Scott, who's calling from Burlington, Vermont, home of Bernie Sanders. Scott, good to have you. What's on your mind?
Hello. Thanks for having me. I'm just looking at some numbers here in Burlington and thinking about what kind of conversation Sanders is thinking about engaging in with Clinton at the convention. And when you look at what happened, you know, Bernie lost by 3-4 million votes in a primary process where 30 of the primaries were closed to independent voters. He's in a country where 42% of the registered voters are independent, 29% are Democrat, about 26% are Republican. And I'm wondering if he's looking at those numbers and going, you know, if I win 55-60% of those independents, break even on the Democrats, you know, depends on turnout and the Electoral College, but I'm in the running. Hmm. I can be president still.
You mean I'm in the running as an independent candidate?
Yeah, as an independent candidate. I think the numbers work well for him. And I'm wondering, you know, he despite what the media says, Bernie was in this to win. It wasn't to make a point. He's in this to be president of the United States.
Well, a couple of things, though, and I want to sort of put this to our panel. But, you know, we spoke here at WBUR on Radio Boston to your governor, Pete Shumlin, earlier this week. And Shumlin's a good Democrat and a Hillary supporter. And he said, I'm also a friend of Bernie Sanders. And Bernie Sanders has assured me that he doesn't want to be a spoiler and he wants to do everything he can, and predicted that he will end up supporting Hillary Clinton in a big way. But what do you think, Katie? Respond to Scott's idea of the possibility that Bernie Sanders could go on as an independent candidate.
I mean, theoretically, he could. But, you know, he himself seemed indicated at the White House on Thursday that, you know, he's in this to stop Donald Trump. And, you know, running as an independent, that would make that much more difficult. The vote would be split among the Democratic Party, and it would make it much more difficult to stop Trump. So the way what Sanders was indicating, you know, on Thursday was that, yes, you know, he's going to wait until he had his rally in Washington. He's going to wait until Washington votes. But, you know, the indication seemed to be that he would at some point back Clinton and really try to have this unity to beat Trump in November.
Right. Well, we should switch gears because I want to leave time to talk about Donald Trump, the Republican presumptive nominee. He continues to worry some top GOP officials with his controversial comments. Most recently, they involved his suggestion that Federal Judge Gonzalo Curiel, who's overseeing the case against the defunct Trump University, would be somehow unable to rule impartially because of his Mexican heritage, a comment that House Speaker Paul Ryan called a textbook example of a racist comment. So Here's Trump this week in an effort to show Republican leaders that he can tone down his rhetoric, using a teleprompter to address his supporters.
You've given me the honor to lead the Republican Party to victory this fall. We're going to do it. We're going to do it, folks. We're going to do it. I understand the responsibility of carrying the mantle, and I will never, ever let you down. Too much work, too many people, blood, sweat, and tears. Never going to let you down.
Jack, what do you think? I mean, did Donald Trump's effort to show that he can be a sort of more contained presidential candidate work this week, help him?
Well, whether it did or not, we'll have to see, or whether he can sustain that note. You know, the attitude of GOP leaders seems to be, sure, he's a racist, but he's our racist. It really echoes FDR on a Latin American dictator. You know, this idea unify around Trump, David Brooks this morning likens that to unifying around a tornado. One threatening really to shatter the GOP on the rocks of demography. California went blue, remember, in the 90s, after a GOP governor led an assault on Hispanics. Almost certainly Trump is going to speed the bluing of Texas. The party of Trump could win this election, but as Mitch McConnell won this week, at the cost of losing the future.
Hmm. Katie, you wrote a piece this week about Ohio Senator Rob Portman and his concerns about Trump. And interesting, because Portman's name had been floated as a possible VP candidate. He's not interested. What did you take away from that interview and with conversations with leading sort of establishment Republican figures like Portman?
Well, I mean, they're definitely trying to walk a fine line. You know, Portman said flat out that it was what Trump said about the judge was not okay. That the judge is from Indiana. He's as American as Rob Portman, who is from Ohio. But on the one hand, Portman is in a very, very tough race in Ohio, a state that has been pummeled by the economy, where they've lost lots and lots of jobs. And Trump's message appeals to many Republicans who he needs their votes in November. So he's really on the one hand, he's trying to say that what Trump has said is not okay. But on the other hand, he's, saying he likes Trump's ideas about the economy. So he's really walking this fine line to try to, appeal to people for his own election in November. One thing I found that was interesting when I asked him if he would be Trump's vice president, and he unequivocally said no. And he said, we have a lot of policy differences and that would be awkward. So, he's definitely trying to hold himself out as, walk himself away from Trump as much as possible. But on the other hand, say, his ideas about the economy are okay, and we need to get manufacturing jobs back, and we need to get American jobs back.
Listeners, we're talking about the week in review, focusing for the time being on the big political stories, the presidential campaign, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump. Where does Bernie Sanders go? Let's go to Dan, who's calling from Williamstown, Massachusetts. Dan, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Thanks for having me. I'm just like to say I'm for Donald Trump and change. I'm for him because I'm the uneducated people that he's reaching out to that want the change to make it a better society for the future instead of the status quo. And it's very exciting with the race that we have going between the two candidates this year. And I haven't voted in a long time. I'm going to vote this year for Donald Trump and change.
So, Dan, you're one of you say you haven't voted for a long time, and one of the things we're hearing about Donald Trump is that he's bringing a lot of folks back into out to the polls who haven't voted in a while. It sounds like you're one of them.
Absolutely. He has his downfalls, but everybody has downfalls, and everybody has a big team behind him to write speeches and this teleprompter stuff. Donald Trump is not a professional politician. He's running for the people to get our country back and strong, and I'm happy for that, and I'm going to vote for him in November.
All right, Dan. Well, thanks so much for calling us. We're very grateful. Jack, I want to come to you. I mean, we heard Dan there, and this idea that if I don't know, Donald Trump reads from a teleprompter and learns discipline, it might help him with folks who are concerned that he can somehow speak without caution. But I'm wondering, on the one hand, message discipline might be good for some candidate, but doesn't it run a risk if he goes too far down this road? He alienates the very folks who like the fact that he's unfiltered and spontaneous.
Yes, yes. And, many of his supporters have been imbued with this idea that from really Rush Limbaugh over the years that, that Barack Obama, you know, graduate of the Harvard Law School, editor of the Law Review and so on, is an empty suit intellectually. And he just reads off teleprompters. And so the whole thing of teleprompter, that's been cued for conservative voters to be something they want to eschew. But, you know, Dan was reflecting something. A Fox poll this week found that to the question of do you want a candidate who will shake up Washington, which seems to be a strong demand, 76% of voters who wanted that chose Trump. Only 25 or so percent chose Clinton.
Hmm. Well, let's hear from Donald Trump again. Here he is Tuesday night talking about Hillary Clinton, saying that she's turned the State Department into her private hedge fund. Here's Donald Trump.
The Clintons have turned the politics of personal enrichment into an art form for themselves. They've made hundreds of millions of dollars selling access, selling favors, selling government contracts, and I mean hundreds of millions of dollars.
So there's Donald Trump speaking Tuesday night. Lisa Lehrer, Trump has promised a speech that's going to, he says, focus on the truth about the Clintons, and that that could come as soon as Monday. What do you expect to hear in that speech?
Well, I think we're going to hear a lot of what he's been saying for the past several months. He's very interested in bringing back a lot of the controversies in the 90s, things like Vince Foster's death and Whitewater and the impeachment hearings. In part, that's a reflection of the people he has around him. He's met with and hired some of the biggest names in the Clinton anti-Clinton world, people like Roger Stone and Ed Klein. There was a report this past week that he was going to potentially hire Dick Morris, who is a Clinton aide from the 90s, who then turned Clinton antagonist to run his Hillary desk and manage those attacks against her. So, you know, I think it's going to be a little bit of a flashback with some stuff about her email server, the private email server she used at the State Department, you know, the Benghazi attacks mixed in. Now, we don't know exactly when the speech is coming, but I think we should expect it sometime this coming week.
Sometime soon. All right, a couple more callers. Let's go to Cynthia, who's calling from Cosby, Tennessee. Cynthia, you're on the air.
Hello, Anthony. I would just make a couple comments. I'm an independent. I will be a Hillary supporter. I would love to see a Hillary-Bernie ticket. But additionally, I would love to sit with some GOP leaders and ask them, how in the world can you support Trump as the party of family values when he's been married multiple times? He admitted he would date his daughter if he could. He's judgmental. They're, you know, judge not lest ye be judged. I don't get it. And why isn't the media not asking these questions directly to him, directly to Paul Ryan? I find myself yelling at the radio. When are you going to ask that question?
All right, Cynthia, we got your point. What do you think, Katie? Are these questions not being asked of Trump? So respond to Cynthia.
You know, they have. And we found this week, you know, a lot of people just didn't want to talk about it. A lot of people kind of hunkered down. They didn't want to say anything. You know, Paul Ryan had his press conference where he, you know, excoriated Trump, but he said he's still supporting him because he is the presumptive Republican nominee and it is the Republican Party. We saw some people take their endorsements away as well.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, during his visit to Washington, India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi addressed Congress with a wink.
Mr. Speaker, I'm informed that the working of the U.S. Congress is harmonious.
Not always. Also today, hockey legend Gordie Howe, best known as Mr. Hockey, died. He died this morning at the age of 88. Tennis star Maria Sharapova, suspended for 2 years after failing a drug test, is appealing the ban. But back in March, she took responsibility.
I received a letter from the ITF that I had failed a drug test at the Australian Open. I did fail the test, and I take full responsibility for it.
and singer Carrie Underwood took home three big awards from the CMT Music Awards this week. Here she is performing Church Bells.
Sing and hear those church bells ringing.
Listeners, you can join the conversation beyond politics. What's moving your world? We're joined today by Katie Zezima, national political correspondent for The Washington Post, Lisa Lehrer, national political reporter for the Associated Press, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. And folks, I want to switch gears and talk about the former Stanford student, Brock Turner, convicted of sexually assaulting a woman at a party last year. He will likely serve just half of his six-month sentence, which has outraged many across the country. The victim of his crime, the 23-year-old woman at the center of the case, published an impassioned statement about the rape that stirred so many people. And on CNN's Legal View Monday, host Ashley Banfield read the entire statement written by the woman. Here she is reading a portion of that, explaining how she felt after the assault.
I stood there examining my body beneath the stream of water, and I decided I don't want my body anymore. I was terrified of it. I didn't know what had been in it, if it had been contaminated, who had touched it. I wanted to take off my body like a jacket and leave it at the hospital with everything else.
So, meanwhile, Judge Aaron Persky, who said he was concerned that a severe sentence would damage Brock Turner's life, is facing a campaign to remove him from the bench. I'd love to get sort of responses from all three of you, starting with you, Lisa. What do you make of this story? Is what has happened going to somehow, I don't know, send some message about how these cases should be handled differently going forward? What do you think?
Well, I think what was so striking about this case was that the victim spoke out. There's some data that says one in six women and one in 33 men in the United States have been the victims of attempted or completed rape in their lifetime. So, you know, this happens. This is not something that isn't going on. But I think most of the time the victims are so traumatized and worried that they won't be believed that they're very reluctant to tell their stories. So the fact that this victim spoke out in such a powerful way is what has captured all the attention and really given people a view into what that process is like, what it is like to be a rape victim. I think that has had a really powerful impact on the country and how the country thinks about sexual assault. Of course, there is this petition to recall the judge in the case. I think the number is up to 1 million people or something like that. It's unclear whether that will succeed. But, you know, we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah. Well, you made mention of the victim's statement, and it was really quite a statement. I recommend to anybody to get a hold of it and have a look at it. It's been published just about everywhere. Katie Zezima, what's your takeaway from this very troubling story?
You know, it is a horrifying story. In many ways, you know, people have said it gives voice to something that, as Lisa said, people don't talk about, that happens, sadly, far too often, and that people don't talk about it. And it's just everyone should read it. It's just an incredibly disturbing, you know, account of what happened to this woman. And it's really, you know, bringing sexual assault into the open and saying that it does happen, and, you know, really just recounting in detail what it is and what it feels like and what it looks like. And you know, I think that's why it's really captured. It's really, you know, so many people are talking about it right now.
Yeah, and Jack, speaking of talking about it, what are you thinking about this story?
Well, you know, Brock Turner was a star swimmer or a swimmer at Stanford, a college athlete. And this week, a study reported on in the Valley News, our newspaper up here, threw light on the connection between undergraduate athletics and sexual assault. It was based on a survey online taken by 379 male undergraduates at a single, according to the study, large public university in the Southeast. And it found that half the men who played an intramural or intercollegiate sport reported having coerced a partner to engage in sexual activity. Half, more than half. That's to say there's something about this athletic whatever it is that's potentially very, very dangerous for women on campus.
It seems like, Jack, that we keep coming back to this story and to one version or another of the kind of conclusion that you just read. And that is that the culture in many of these athletic sports teams somehow give rise to this again and again and again. You know, and I asked the question, do we think that this case is somehow going to change something going forward? I got to say, I'm pessimistic.
Well, yeah, I mean the grip of alumni on intercollegiate athletics is powerful. You know, there was a very good documentary about this. CNN did it. I think it was called The Hunting Ground. And you watch it and you think, my God, these young men, they're cursed. What's wrong with them? Well, the documentary made clear that most of these sexual assaults are committed by the same people. In other words, this isn't, even though this the study suggests it's pretty widespread, the documentary seemed to say, well, it's not all that widespread, because if you look at these are people who do it again and again. And they interviewed one of these people, young men, and he talked about women the way a hunter would about, you know, hunting game. I mean, it was just a kind of, I'm stalking her. And that he got off on that, on the power thing. I want to believe that the documentary was correct, and that is an accurate portrait of young men, that they're not all in this terrible situation, but that most of these assaults are committed are by serial offenders.
Sure. Well,
I also think, Anthony, it shows how the conversation has changed in the past couple years. I mean, this was something that we really weren't talking about. Look, rape is a crime as old as humanity, right? But sexual assault on campus is something that we really weren't talking about 5 years ago. And as someone who spends a lot of her time thinking about Hillary Clinton, as given that I cover her, I think it's also interesting to think about how much the conversation has shifted in the past 8 years around women, although sexual assault is not solely something that happens to women, it is often considered more of a, a women's issues sort of thing around women and how we think about women and how aggressive people are about sexism and assault. In the past 8 years since she ran last time, I think it is a pretty different, she's running now in a very different context.
Hmm. Well, let's go to Trey, who's calling from Columbia, South Carolina, with a comment about this particular story. Trey, thanks for calling.
I heard the panel talking about how the frequency of this happens, it happens in colleges, it even happens in the military a lot as well. But I wanted to focus on the disparity of the amount of time that he's gotten and how that usually carries a larger amount of time. In fact, there's been several black college athletes that were charged with the very exact same crime and obviously received, 15 to 30. Whereas this guy gets 6 months, and the reasoning behind not ruining his life, but what about the victim? Her life is ruined probably forever when she gets married. She's constantly reminded of this assault.
Trey, thanks so much for that. And by the way, just to be clear, Brock Turner got a 6-month sentence. We're learning, I think, just yesterday that he'll probably only have to serve 3 months of that. So, Jack, there's Trey talking about this issue that comes up again and again when we're talking about the criminal justice system of disparity in the way folks are sentenced.
Yes, and of course, the judge himself was a former athlete at Stanford, and he gave a sentence that the victim rightly called a soft timeout. That's really what it is. Although he will be put on the sex registry, sex offender registry, and that is a sort of scarlet letter for perhaps for his life.
Yeah. Well, I want to move on and make sure we've got some time to talk about a couple of other things, including Muhammad Ali, who died this week. The great boxer, multiple world champion. And I'm going to guess that the three of you aren't diehard boxing fans, but it's sort of hard not to have noticed Muhammad Ali in a big way. Katie, let me come to you. What were you thinking this week about Muhammad Ali?
I mean, just, he's an icon. I mean, he really... not only in the boxing ring, but outside of the ring, calling for justice, that sort of thing. He's really just an iconic American figure, and it's a tremendous loss.
Yeah. What do you think, Lisa?
I mean, what a life, right? I really enjoyed reading all those obituaries. That was some great reading, and it's unbelievable the number of people his life touched. I believe at the funeral on Friday, you have everyone from Bill Clinton to Senator Orrin Hatch, the Republican from Utah, giving eulogies. So it's certainly someone that a lot of people are remembering.
You know, Jack, thinking of sort of growing up as a kid, I grew up in a household where I would say there was sort of mild attention paid to sports, none to boxing, except when Muhammad Ali sort of stepped into the scene. And then it was irresistible. And of course, it was about the fight, but it was also about the personality, about the magnetism, about, I mean, he brought something to that sport that I don't think anyone has brought since.
I saw him fight in the 1960 Olympics when he was lithe, thin, and it was just, I've never forgotten it. It was just, I think he was about 19 years old. You know, a speaker at the Muslim memorial service yesterday called Muhammad Ali a symbol of national unity, and it jarred with that symbolism that Louis Farrakhan was there. His Nation of Islam symbolizes anti-Semitism. The Southern Poverty Law Center classifies it as a hate group. Ali put that hate behind him when he converted to Orthodox Islam. He was the greatest, partly because he overcame so much, including an unworthy loyalty in his past.
Mm. Well, let's take a couple of calls. We've got listeners who want to chime in about Muhammad Ali, his passing this week. Let's go to Edith, who's calling from Canton, Connecticut. Hi, Edith. You're on the air. Great to have you.
Hello. There's no question Ali was a great boxer. Ali refused to go into the service. I can't forget that because so many people did. And if they chose not to, they did some sort of community service. Now, he did have his title taken away for 3 years, and that was a punishment of sorts. But I think, and I'm sorry he had Parkinson's and suffered so much. He was philanthropic. He was funny. He was poetic. He was all of those things. But I think the publicity has been overdone. And it's not to take away from his goodness in his later years and his understanding of other religions. And I just think that many people die today who have been just as honorable, just as American, just as good, who don't even get recognized. So that's my comment.
All right, Edith. Well, thanks so much for that. Let's go to Samuel, who's calling from Shrewsbury, Mass. Hi, Samuel. You're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. How are you?
I'm very well.
Great. My belief of Ali and his legacy is that he is a great man, but he also had a, as anybody does, he has his own sins, and that's what I think that that needs also to be talked about. We can't just talk about, you know, he was a great man, he was a worldly man, but he also believed in, and maybe it was modified through his life, but he believed that people should live, or the races should be living apart. And that was through the 70s that he was, I believe, right up until 75, and at least the what I read. And so that's what I'd like to bring to the conversation is that you need to speak to all of the man and not just the pieces that people want to glorify. And remember, we need to remember because it continues to bring the dialogue. It continues to have people think about.
Samuel, I'm glad you brought this up. Let me throw this to the panel. I mean, I'll start with you, Jack. I mean, a couple of calls there. The first one saying he's being over-celebrated. Samuel talking about, some of Muhammad Ali's ideas that were at odds with what folks might consider sort of American values. I mean, are we running the risk of sort of sweetening everything in a kind of, an effort to sort of glorify him?
Well, you know, I think there's been some of that, certainly when last week in the initial outpouring. But I think as the man, warts and all, has appeared, in a way his greatness has grown. He grew as a human being. You know, one of the poignant things about him was, as someone said, he may never have read a book in his life. He had terrible trouble with reading, was just passed on in the Louisville schools. And, you know, he was vulnerable to the appeal of a Louis Farrakhan and indeed a Malcolm X. He transcended that. No one would say that he was for racial exclusion or isolation now. And with the Vietnam War, I see Edith's point. But in a way, hasn't history caught up with Ali and said that was a brave and noble moment?
All right. Well, he floated like a butterfly. He stung like a bee. Muhammad Ali died this week. We're going to end it there. Lisa Lair of the Associated Press and Katie Zezem of the Washington Post, thank you both so much.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, thank you, Jack. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Anthony Brooks, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.